The Bible doesn't seem to have a word for insects as such. There are plenty of insects in the Bible. At the Birmingham Choir at the moment, we're doing Handel's Israel in Egypt and trying to get our tongues around fleas and flies. Where was I? So, yes, we're going to think about what the Bible, I think, refers to as creeping things. So God said, "Let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth, according to its kind. And it was so." Now, some of the modern version, particularly NIV, translates that creeping thing as reptiles. Now, reptiles, it's true, do tend to move along the ground. But I would have thought, from a non-scientific point of view, you would count lizards and crocodiles and creatures like that as animals. I don't think you would have a separate word between animals and reptiles. And I think to see creeping things as at least including insects is reasonable. I'll come back to that in a moment. Now, it's important to just realise how important insects are to the whole of creation, to the whole world that we live in. They are, of course, by far and away the most abundant creatures. I mean, whereas with animals and birds and even humans, you might talk in hundreds or millions or even billions. There's far too many humans now, but when you talk of insects, the numbers are just almost beyond imagination. We are told there are something up to 1 million different species of insect, and of course they are an essential part of the ecosystem, of the whole balance of nature that God has put in place. And perhaps the most important role they play is as pollinators of, well, a large proportion of the crops that give us the food we eat. Without insects, we would literally starve. And, we don't always acknowledge that when we have, insects have a fairly negative view amongst us, don't they? Because we think of them as things that bite and sting, that are a nuisance. That time just before harvest, when those little tiny thunderflies come out and you're doing the washing up and they're pitching on your face, it drives you mad. They are, of course, the supply for many animals and birds, particularly birds and even fish. So, again, their abundance is able to supply the needs of many other creatures. But we also have to recognise that they are pests in many cases. They are major crop pests, and of course they carry some pretty awful diseases. Diseases like malaria and sleeping sickness and so on, just to name two. So we see God's hand, don't we? Because we live in a fallen creation where there is a curse as well as blessing. And all these things work together. So what about insects in the Bible then? This word translated creeping things, it's a Hebrew word remez, occurs about 17 times. And as you see, things that creep and crawl and reptile is the alternative. There's another word, sherets, which basically means there's a lot of them. The swarm, the things that increase abundantly. And we think of, the plagues on Egypt and the fleas and the flies and so on. And just a few occurrences in the New Testament. Well, really, it's mainly Peter's dream, his vision, when he was hungry and he saw the sheet let down. "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." And amongst the things there were creeping things, which again the NIV translates reptile. But having said that, there's no specific word for insects. There are lots of individual insects mentioned in the Bible. And so we've got, well, you can read them. Ants, hornets, leeches, beetles or crickets, lice or gnats, cankerworms and so on, moths, fleas and flies. I've included spiders. I know they're not true insects because they've got eight legs instead of six. And we have worms, which are not insects at all. They're invertebrates or something. When I first did this talk some years ago at a Coventry Creation Day, the other speaker was Brother Stephen Palmer, and I enjoyed pointing out that there he was. Now, it's amazing that until, well, the 19th century, it was generally thought that insects just occurred spontaneously. If you had some rotting meat and maggots appeared, they had spontaneously appeared from inside the meat. And was it Pasteur who showed that if you put a cover over it and kept the flies away, you didn't get any maggots? But the first man really to get down on his hands and knees and study insects and see what they did and where they came from was this gentleman, a Frenchman obviously, Jean-Henri Fabre. And he's been called the father of modern entomology. And he spent years and years studying insects minutely, seeing their behaviour, how they work, and the astonishing life cycles and patterns that they have, some of which we'll think about this evening. And not only was he a brilliant naturalist in observing what was going on, he was a very good writer. And he wrote entertaining stories and narratives which appeared in the popular press. And you probably know in the Victorian era, it became very fashionable to study living things and natural history. And it tapped into that. So he greatly popularised the study of insects. One of the things that he showed was the importance of instinct. That insects with their tiny brains don't think things out. They operate purely on a pre-programmed line that tells them what to do next. One of the things he showed, you've probably all seen film, if you haven't actually watched it happening, a spider spinning its web and the stages that it goes through and how it puts out the radial lines and then starts, I think, from the outside and works towards the centre. And he showed, if you took the spider away for a few seconds and stopped it where it was and then put it back in the same place, it couldn't carry on and finish the web. It had to start the whole process over again. It worked from a program and it, which said start here and carry on. And one of his groundbreaking experiments, this is a caterpillar called the pine processionary. And they live in the tops of pine. They're a real pest to pine plantations in America. But at night, they form up into a long column, each caterpillar following the one in front. And they come down and consume the pine needles and then go back at night. So what he did, what Fabre did, was get a line of these pine processionary larvae and get the front one around to link on to the back one. So he had them in a rough circle. And then he put some food, presumably pine needles, just outside the circle. And they carried walking round and round for 6 days. See, instinct, just you follow the one in front till you get to where you're supposed to be going, the food supply. Now, Charles Darwin read Fabre's work and was very impressed by it. But it's interesting that Fabre was a Christian and he never accepted Darwinism. And here was someone who really studied insects in depth. And he could see that evolution could not possibly explain the sort of behaviours that he saw. One of the creatures that he studied was parasitic wasps. Now, wasps, there are quite a number of different species who lay their eggs, the female lays her eggs in the bodies of caterpillars. And when their eggs hatch out, they eat the caterpillar from the inside. Now, it's a bit gruesome, isn't it? Charles Darwin said, "I cannot conceive that a God of love would create a creature like that." See, he claimed that it must have evolved. But in fact, it is so incredibly clever what they do. The wasp lays her eggs in the caterpillar and injects it with a venom which doesn't kill it. It paralyzes it, because the wasp larvae are not going to feed on rotting meat. They want fresh meat. So it's kept the larva of the host is kept alive so that the wasp larvae eat fresh meat. And so the host is kept alive. And now there's a picture of an unfortunate caterpillar that's absolutely infested with the parasitic wasps. And these are the larvae that have escaped, have eaten their way out and are pupated and are about to hatch. And here's the next generation of wasps hatching from the egg. Now, in fact, this is an important control on many pests. One of the caterpillars, this one, is the tobacco hornworm. Now, we might think actually that's quite a good thing, because it's a pest for tobacco growers. But tobacco growers don't see it that way. And these parasitic wasps are an important control of this pest. Let's go to something a bit more wholesome, and that's one of the insects that we all love are butterflies, because I mean there's so many different colours and types. I mean, I have to say to the young among you, you just don't know what you've missed, because when we were young, there were butterflies everywhere, and they were so common, and all the really colourful ones, red admirals, painted ladies and so on, that us lads used to catch them with a net and kill them with formaldehyde and put a pin through them and collect them. And there were so many that you didn't think they were doing anything wrong. Now, there are so few. It's really sad because of agricultural methods, the use of pesticides and so on. Now, the large blue became extinct in Britain during the 60s. Nobody knew why. And a professor at Oxford University decided to go to Sweden, where they were still plentiful, and try and find out their life cycle and see why they died out in this country. His name was Jeremy Thomas, but not our Jeremy Thomas. And what he discovered was that the large blue, in order to fulfil its life cycle, depends on another insect. It's a red ant. And when the female blue, large blue, lays her eggs on a particular plant, they hatch out and the larvae are very small, even though it's a large blue. The caterpillars are very small, and they feed on this plant for 2 or 3 weeks, and then they spin. They spin a length of silk and drop to the ground. I mean, isn't it amazing that they can do things like that? And they lay on the ground waiting until along comes a red ant. And it's thought that the females actually lay their eggs in the vicinity of an ant's nest. And the caterpillar picks up the larva and carries it to the nest. And you might think, oh, tasty meal for the ants. But no, it's the other way round. The blue caterpillar, the caterpillar eats the ant's eggs and feeds on them, but it also exudes a sweet substance from it, from a gland on its back, which the ants like and eat. So it's a mutual thing. So that they actually, the ants look after the caterpillar until it pupates, it spins its cocoon inside the ant's nest. It's believed that they actually deceive the ants both by pheromones, you know, these chemical scents that insects exude, that it gives off pheromones that the ants use. And it also, the ants, this was in David Attenborough's Life in the Undergrowth a few years ago, that they now know, using super powerful microphones, that insects make noises and that we can't hear, of course, but they can. They communicate using sound, and that the large blue caterpillar can imitate the sound of the ant. That's pretty astounding things, if it can make the same complicated chemical pheromone and make the same noise. So it deceives the ants by smell and sound. And then when it hatches, the ants actually escort the butterfly, with its wings folded up, of course, out of the nest and say, bye, thanks, in effect. There is, however, a parasitic wasp which is not fooled by the caterpillar and can actually find it inside the ant's nest and lay its eggs inside the large blue. So they were able to reintroduce. Now, why had it died out? And the answer was myxomatosis. And you think, what's myxomatosis got to do with butterflies? Well, myxomatosis killed the rabbits, which used to crop the grass on the South Downs and keep it to a certain length, beloved by this particular species of ant. When the rabbits died out, the grass grew longer, the ants went away, no more blue butterflies. Isn't it? It's just an example of how, you know, three, four different organisms are all interacting to produce wonderful results. Here's another wasp. This was a brother in Australia sent me a picture of this on the windowsill outside his house, and I wrote a little piece of the testimony. And incidentally, of course, some of these stories are in this certain book that's recently been published. Now, the marvellous thing here, well, I suppose it's with all these parasitic wasps, but this one in particular, is that the wasp seems to have forethought. It plans for the future. Now, you would say, a wasp can't plan for anything, can it? Its brain is too small to do things like that. But the female wasp, when she's been, when she's mated, makes a little pot out of mud using her own saliva and water that she finds, and she builds this exquisite pot. And that's going to be a larder. She then finds some caterpillars, probably of a certain type. There are various species of potter wasp, so probably preying on certain types of caterpillar. And again, paralyses it and places it in the pot, ready for its hosts. And then she lays her eggs in the caterpillar's body, and then she dies. She's finished with her part. After she's dead, the larvae hatch out, and as before, they feed on the larder. And, you know, we have this, again, this control of pest species. So where did the forethought come from? Who planned this sequence of events? Who planned how you make a pot? I mean, that's no mean feat for a tiny insect, is it? And there's only one possible answer. It is impossible for a complex process like that to have arisen by chance, I would submit. And of course, the forethought in this case comes from the Creator. Enough of wasps. Let's think about beetles. And there are thousands and thousands of different types of beetle. This is a particularly extraordinary one, I think. It's called the fire beetle or the jewel beetle. And you all know from the news recently of massive fires in Portugal and currently in California, all apparently due to the changing climate. Now, when there's a forest fire, everything that can get away gets away. They fly, run, move out the way. But the fire beetle heads straight towards the fire. They're called, the Latin name is Melanophila, black loving, because they like the blackened trees that have been burnt. Because, of course, trees, we don't often think about this, trees have defence mechanisms to prevent and dissuade insects from attacking them. But once they've been burnt, those mechanisms are disabled. So the tree becomes unable to prevent the laying of eggs. So the fire beetles fly towards the forest fire. They find trees that have been burnt. They mate on the trees and lay their eggs in the blackened timber. Because, as I say, the tree's defence mechanisms have been overcome. Now, there are some well-attested stories of... There was an oil refinery fire in California. The nearest forests were 50 miles away, and beetles turned up. They registered the fire, and it was the wrong sort for them. But so it's possible they travel up to 50 miles to get to the fire. Now, how do they do that? How do they know that there's a nice forest fire that's preparing trees for them to lay their eggs in? And it turns out that they have two separate detection systems. One is that it appears that on their antennae they have smoke detectors. So that would, of course, depend on the wind direction. But there are chemicals in smoke, particularly pine smoke, which is their favoured tree. There's a chemical called guaiacol. Laboratory tests have shown that they respond to this chemical. But even cleverer than that, they have heat detectors. Now, of course, being insects, they have six legs. Four of their legs, when they're flying, are held down. But the middle legs are up like this in the air. They fly with the legs up here. And underneath the pits are heat detectors. Here we are. So that's, this diagram is showing these heat detectors under each arm, or each leg rather. And each of these little red balls here is called a sensilla, because it's sensing infrared radiation, which you get from heat from a fire. And they've shown that the detectors are actually tuned to a wavelength of 3 micrometres. That's a technical bit, but a particular wavelength of heat, which comes from, you've guessed it, forest fires. And each of these little balls, you can imagine, it absorbs heat and increases the pressure inside, and that presses on the tip of the nerve ending here and sends a signal to the brain. Now, having two is quite clever, because if the fire's over there and you're flying in that direction, you'll get more heat under this one than you will under this one. So you swing round. So you can always direct yourself directly to the fire, yourself, the beetle. Would you like to think about how something like that could have come about by chance? Yeah, organs as complex as that in the right place. Were there lots of experiments having them under different arms or both on one side, so went round in circles? You know, it's just everything about it says that it's been carefully thought out by the Creator. Now, another wonderful beetle, you may have heard of this, is the bombardier beetle. And the bombardier beetle has a unique defence mechanism in that it can, when it's attacked, it can squirt boiling hot steam at whatever's attacking it. A spider or another, a larger creature, a bird or something. It actually has, well, let's say lots of beetles have noxious chemicals in their body, so that a bird that comes along and, you know, has a mouthful of beetle gets a vile taste in its mouth, so it decides, well, that beetle's had it, but its friends will survive because the bird learns you don't eat those because they've got noxious chemicals in. But this beetle has two chemicals. One of them you probably won't, well, those of you who have to put your teeth in hydrogen peroxide at night to sterilise them, hope there's nobody here like that. You never know. So it's hydrogen peroxide and a chemical called hydroquinone. If you mix those together, nothing happens. But if you add a catalyst is a chemical which doesn't get used up in the reaction, but speeds it up hundreds, thousands of times. So you need this catalyst, which in a living creature is called an enzyme. So you've got, well, I think there's a diagram here somewhere. Yeah, so here's a diagram. So it's got two glands that produce hydroquinone. It's got two storage vessels for hydrogen peroxide. When it's attacked, it mixes those and puts them into this expansion chamber. Now, it's got a sphincter muscle there. That's a muscle like we use to prevent us going to the loo. It's to hold it in. So they can hold the material in until, poof, out it comes at about boiling point. And it also, hydroquinone breaks down to quinone, which is a very nasty, bitter substance. It's quite amazing, isn't it? All that's been carefully put together. Now, this beetle has become a sort of icon for creation and intelligent design. So the evolutionists have had to come back and say, ah, yes, well, lots of beetles have got hydroquinone in them. And hydrogen peroxide is quite common in living creatures. So the beetle has just exploited what was already there. As though it thought, well, I've got this and I've got that. And it's the enzyme. I'll have to experiment to find an enzyme that makes the explosion happen. And, well, there you are. There's a lovely picture of someone getting their thumb rather hot. The tail here, the exhaust, is swivel. It can move it around and so it can go sideways or upwards or backwards or even under its legs as it's doing there. So amazing, amazing thing. Let's get biblical again. One of the many plants of the land, or perhaps one of the iconic plants of Israel, is of course the fig. And figs have a unique life cycle, absolutely amazing, unique life cycle. Have you ever seen fig flowers? Well, I can say it confidently because you don't see fig flowers, because the flowers of the fig are inside the fig. This body, to start with, is called a syconium, and the flowers are inside. So how does it get pollinated? And the answer is each species of fig has a unique pollinator, which is another wasp. See how important wasps are in the living world. And there is a tiny little hole on the end of the fig body called an osteole. After the female fig has mated, she's got her eggs on board, she crawls, finds a tree, crawls in through that tiny hole. She's a very small insect. In the process, her wings break off and are left behind. And she crawls into the fig. The wasps only feed and mate inside the fig. So those wasps are totally dependent on the fig for their life. And the fig is totally dependent on the wasp to be pollinated. Just think about that and how that could come about. You know, evolutionists here really talk about co-evolution. They evolved together to get to this stage. You can't dream up how those stages could come about. They call it mutualism, which is fine. You know, each species is totally dependent on the other. Well, we aren't going to that again. So here's a sort of diagram of, I won't go into it in too much detail, you can always read the book. But here there are male and female flowers inside the fig body. The wasp lays her eggs in some of the flowers, and at the same, because she's from the tree she's just come from, she's carrying pollen, so she pollinates the female flowers inside the syconium. Flowers that contain a wasp develop a thing called a gall, so they don't produce fruit, and the next generation of wasps develop inside. As the fig matures, the male wasps come out first, and they crawl around and find females which are still in their galls, and they inseminate them. So, and this is all exquisite timing. You know, each process depends on the fruit and the wasp interact, so their timing is totally interrelated. So the male flowers have matured by the time the female wasps come out from their galls. So the pollen is there, ready, as the female emerges. She's already been mated, and she picks up pollen from the male flowers. Now she's got to get out. And that's where the males come in again. They dig a hole out to the outside world, and then they're finished and they die inside the fig. And then, so the females emerge and fly away to find another tree, and the cycle goes again. It's just incredible, isn't it? Now you might say, do you like figs? What about those wasps inside? I've read various stories about this, but there are different types of fig. There's the cultivated fig. And it's very interesting. When they were first taken to California, which is ideal growing country for them, they didn't get any figs because they didn't know about the wasps. There were no wasps. And it wasn't until, you know, it was realised that you needed wasps that they were taken over there to start producing figs. But there's also the sycamore fig. Now, we know about that from the Bible, don't we? Because Amos was a grower of sycamore fruit. That's the fruit of the sycamore fig, which is a a tree that grows all across Africa and is a major food source for things like fruit bats and many other creatures. The figs have the wasp bodies in them, which is why they're considered second rate. Cultivated figs produce an enzyme which dissolves the bodies of the wasps. So if you, as I do, I love figs, no wasps in them. So this fantastic interaction of two totally different creatures, the fig and the fig wasp. And as I say, they call it coevolution. We know better. Well, spiders. I know, not true insects, but they're wonderful as well, aren't they? And this amazing product that they produce, spider silk, or I should say silks, really, because the average species of spider produces 5 or 6 different types of silk according to what it's being used for. You probably know some small spiders produce a drag line and they let go of whatever they're on and the wind carries them away, and they travel using the drag line like a sort of parachute. There's the silk that they spin for the web. Two sorts there. There's the sticky stuff that goes around, which has got to trap the insects. But there's the supporting struts, which are not sticky. And then they spin cocoons for their eggs when they're ready to, when they are laid. Spider silk is amazingly strong material for the same size, same gauge, width. It's stronger than steel, but unlike steel, it will stretch 40% of its length without breaking. It's elastic and can absorb far more energy than steel would be able to. Now, you might think, coming out of a simple insect, it would just be a smooth substance, but it's the actual structure of the silk is very complicated, as we'll see in just a moment. And point I just made about the different types. And of course, the amazing thing, if you ever go to grab a spider and it goes zoop, it just produces silk instantly, doesn't it? On demand. The speed at which it can produce it is quite amazing. Now, the way that it makes silk is with this gland called a spinneret. And within it, it produces within the spinneret, produces a material called spidroin, which is rather thick, glutinous protein material. And nobody knows quite how it persuades it to go down a little tiny tube called the S duct, down to where it's going to come out into the air. But I think it's in the form of a liquid crystal. Now, you all know about liquid crystals because they're all in your mobile phone displays. And although they're quite thick, gooey things, they can change instantly shape and colour using electricity. Now, when it gets to the point of exit here and produces the silk, something quite amazing happens. Inside the spinneret, it's a water-based solution. But if the spider's web was a water-based material, when it rained, it would just dissolve away, wouldn't it? Wouldn't be any use at all. And we all know when we most see spider's webs is in the autumn, when it's covered in drops of water. So how does it get from being water-loving to waterproof? Now, the materials that it's made of, which I call proteins, they're very large, complex chemical molecules, but they have two sorts of two parts. One part loves water, and one part loves oil, it's water hating. Now, when it's inside the spinneret, it's the water loving bit that's on the outside. Just as it gets to the exit, the protein rearranges so that the oil loving bit's on the outside. That's fantastic, isn't it? Can you... One is lost for in admiration. Now, I said that it's a complex structure. Look, it's got four different layers. It's spun out, and it's got four different layers. A fibre core, an inner membrane. This bit here, which is shown here, are called nanofibrils. Nano means very, very small. But it's got protein chains connecting larger bits, nanocrystals. So that's what gives it its stretchability. Beautifully designed, isn't it? And then it's got an outer sheath. Now, wouldn't human chemical engineers love to design something like that? You know, the nearest thing that in human synthetic fibres is something called Kevlar. You may have heard of Kevlar. It's used in bulletproof vests and things like that. It's a very expensive, very clever synthetic fibre. It's made in chemical plants at high pressure, near to boiling point. It uses concentrated sulfuric acid. Oof. Nasty stuff. And it produces a lot of hazardous waste. So just compare that with the superior product that the spider makes at just the normal pressure of a spider, body temperature, water and protein. It's just no comparison, is there? And yet, you know, the cleverest chemists in the world produce things like this. So who designed this? Oh, there's no waste because, you know, they can eat it. They can reabsorb it, can't they? They can climb back up their line that they've dropped, eating it as they go to recycle the materials. That's, you know, it's just fantastic. Another amazing creature that mankind uses is the silkworm. And the silkworm is not a worm, it's a caterpillar of this moth. It's a poor little feeble moth, and they no longer occur in nature. They only live in silk factories. And of course, I'm sure, know that it was the Chinese who discovered this wonderful material. It's said that it was discovered in China 2,500 years ago. It's in the Bible, of course, silk. Because it's always been considered the supreme textile. You know, the qualities of silk are unmatched. Even, you know, the best synthetic fibres can't match the qualities of silk. Any of you sisters wearing silk blouses and silk scarves? Silk ties. There's nothing to touch a silk tie. I have one or two. Yeah, in Ezekiel, it's among the list of products, you know, that were traded in the ancient world. And it's in Revelation as well, being tomorrow's chapters, I think, as one of the products traded by Great Babylon. So there you are. So what we call the silk worm is actually the caterpillar. And it has two glands on the two sides of its mouth which produce the silk. And of course, what it produces silk for is to spin the cocoon when it pupates. There you can see one that's been cut open. There's the pupa inside. And the amazing thing about silkworms is the amount they produce. There's a cocoon, 100 metres per cocoon. Now, of course, it's exceedingly fine, and it has to be spun into a fibre that you can use, but that's an incredible amount. Why do they produce so much? Possibly they've been bred, you know, selective breeding has increased the amount they produce, but it's still quite extraordinary. And it's just one example of many in the natural world, creatures that produce far more than you would think they need for man's benefit. So again, who thought that out? I mean, the fact that you can get cows to produce gallons and gallons of milk that we happily tip into our tea and coffee and cereal. There are many examples. 60,000 tons a year of silk is produced. That's an awful lot of... The unfortunate cocoon, the larva, you know, because in order to get the silk, they heat it up so that the poor old thing inside dies. They just keep sufficient to keep production going for the next cycle. I can only think that, you know, this is part of divine provision. Now, we've talked several times about what goes on inside that thing, pupation. And so many insects have this lifestyle where they begin as an egg, which hatches into a larva or caterpillar, and the larva is a feeding machine. They don't do much else except eat. They have no reproductive organs. They just feed and feed and feed, gathering the material which will be used after pupation or metamorphosis, that's what we're going to mention now, so that the final insect will have all the material it needs in order to reproduce. So that's the cycle, isn't it? Here's the egg, hatches into the caterpillar, pupates, and what goes on inside there is still not known. It's absolutely... The body of the caterpillar simply dissolves into a liquid mush. And out of the liquid mush forms a butterfly or a moth. It's extraordinary. And out comes something as beautiful as what's called the imago, the final product, the beautiful creation that was intended. There's a picture of a painted lady emerging from its chrysalis. And how it's all beautifully folded up. And then it spreads its wings and takes heat from the sun, and the wings fill with fluid so that they become stiff. And this flimsy creature can fly and do all sorts of things. In the case of the monarch butterfly, which that's supposed to be, it migrates from Mexico to Canada. And even more clever than that, it's not the same butterfly that leaves Mexico and gets to Canada. They stop and reproduce on the way, so the next generation goes on the next bit. And I remember on a visit to Canada, standing on the shore of Lake Ontario and watching literally thousands of monarch butterflies coming across the lake on their summer migration to Canada. You can't believe that a tiny creature like that can fly, can migrate over hundreds, thousands of miles. Well, I could just go on all night, and you're glad I'm not going to. But I've said many more wonders. Butterfly flight and migration, you know. Quite extraordinary. Termites, these amazing creatures, which build these huge mounds in Africa and Australia. They're often thought of as ants, but they're not ants. They're a unique, different type of creature. But these mounds are temperature controlled. They build tunnels, and they can open and shut the openings so that the air travels up through and keeps the whole mound at a constant temperature. How do they do that? Cicadas, nature's loudest insect. Their life cycle is, you keep using the word amazing, wonderful, because you run out of words to say anything different. But cicadas, they live most of their lives as larvae underground, feeding on the roots of trees, on fungi and so on. And many species, once every 17 years, they emerge, they crawl up a tree and the mature insect emerges, and it's got extraordinary ears, which are also like, well, they're called tympanums, they're like drum, and they make this fantastic noise, which is really lots of decibels, in order to call their mates, and the whole region becomes battered by the noise of these things, particularly in America, Australia. Again, they mate, the females go down and lay their eggs, the larvae hatch and live underground for another 17 years. How do they all know? It's time to go, chaps. I had to mention this incredible spider, the Portia spider, because scientists have been studying it because it's so clever. It's a very small spider, and it's camouflaged to look like leaf litter, like dead leaves. And it's a jumping spider. It doesn't spin its own web. It feeds off other spiders that are spinning their webs. So it's a predator of spiders. And with its tiny brain, it sits on a plant and spots a spider, a few feet away on another plant, spinning its web, and it waits until it thinks, time's right. It makes a mental plan somehow of where that other spider is, the target, crawls down its tree across the ground, up the other plant, and it knows exactly where that web is. Now they reckon that even quite higher creatures like monkeys couldn't do anything as clever as that. But this tiny spider does. When it gets to the web, it taps it to simulate an insect that's been caught and is desperately trying to get away, until eventually the target spider says, "Oh, I've caught something," comes crawling across and whoosh. Now, you will be aware I haven't mentioned the cleverest insect of all by far, because there's two beekeepers here who know far more, and really, honeybees warrant a whole evening on their own. And I remember many years ago at East Anglian Youth Group, Brother Eric giving us a wonderful talk on honeybees. I'll put the picture up. And one thing I've never forgotten, he told you about the cells that the bees make out of beeswax, that two different sizes, one for storing honey, am I right? And one for laying the eggs in.
Drone.
Pardon?
Yeah, there's a bigger one for drones, for male.
Oh, right, okay. Bees. I didn't get that bit quite right, sorry. So he got, of course, the clever thing, the cells are hexagonal. They're a regular hexagon, six sides, because regular hexagons pack together with no spaces in between. And he got us all to get a pencil and paper and draw a regular hexagon. Now, I'm quite good at drawing regular hexagon because, as a chemist, the shape of a regular hexagon is used in thousands of different chemical compounds called aromatic compounds. They all have regular hexagons, so you get used to drawing them. And then Eric said, "Now shut your eyes and draw a regular hexagon with your eyes shut." That's not so easy, because, of course, the bees do it in the dark. They can't see what they're doing. And that's just one. They're wonderful creatures, of course, and we benefit from them. And they're one of the main pollinators, as we know. They're under severe stress in the modern world, and scientists aren't too sure why, I believe. So, they're all the works of the great Creator. And back in Job chapter 12, Job puts it so beautifully. He says, "Ask the beasts, and they will tell you, and the birds of the air, and they will tell you," and we could add, "and the insects, they will tell you, or speak to the earth, and it will teach you that the hand of the Lord has done this, in whose hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind." And so how these things surely should cause us to praise and glorify our Creator. Wild animals and all cattle, small creatures and flying birds, let them praise the name of the Lord, for his name alone is exalted. His glory is above the earth and the heavens.